Good morning. My name's Randy Youngblood. I'm lead pastor, and I'm so glad that we're all able to be here together today. We're wrapping up a series on becoming a man after God's own heart. We're looking at a very imperfect man, but yet, in spite of his imperfections, he was someone that God called a man after my own heart. This week is humble faith, and I don't know why, but it seems like in spite of my best intentions, I often find myself on a path of humility or humiliation. Sometimes there's a fine line between the two. This week it happened at the grocery store. My wife had wanted a particular kind of yogurt, and you know, this is not the, you know, we're not in the era anymore where rise, I will kill and we'll eat. But I went to the grocery store to get her a yogurt, the kind of yogurt that she wanted. And I went to a different store, so they had something different, and I thought I got something better. But something better, which is different, isn't usually better. And I brought it home, proud of myself, and I said, I got you something better. And she said, it's not what I wanted. And so I thought, oh, I'm so sorry. So being a good husband, the next day, I kept the receipt, and I went back to the store. I thought, this is going to be embarrassing. But not as it was even more embarrassing than I anticipated, as I'll tell you in a moment. Because the next day, I took it, and I went back to the store, and I knew I was going to have to explain why I was a doofus about the wrong yogurt for my wife. But yet, there was a question I had about it. I thought, make sure that it wasn't opened. And I looked at it, and the little foil thing under the plastic lid was intact, and it felt heavy. So I thought, you know, no, it's good. So I explained, I'm so sorry. I bought the wrong stuff for my wife, and I'm bringing it back. So I went home, and that night I expected to be able to tell her what I did, how I humbled myself for her, and yet she said, Rand, I already opened it. How could you have done that? You need to go back and give them their money back because they can't sell that. And I thought, oh, this just got worse. And I thought, that thought occurred to me, but I looked at it and all my senses were a little under par and couldn't detect that it had been opened. So next day I was going to have to go back. And so I walked the humble path. And at the same time, I was afraid, I was hoping that the person that had given me the refund would be there because I thought, surely she opened it and she discovered it and didn't put it back on the shelf, but she's going to open and find that it was open and think poorly of me. So I went back later in the day. I finally got around to it, and I was so grateful that the same person was there. But she said, oh, I didn't know. I didn't notice, so, which meant they threw it away if you're wondering what the stores do with that. So I felt bad, but I had to explain, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that it was opened, and I need to give you your money back. She wouldn't take it, but I wish she had. I would have felt better. But why is it sometimes, in spite of our best intentions, we end up walking that humble path that gets really frustrating and embarrassing? Where have you found yourself on that humble path that leads into tough situations where you're not quite sure how to respond? Now, when we talk about tough situations, yogurt hardly qualifies, but yet there was a humiliation there that is common in a lot of the tough paths that we're on, but there are many situations tougher than that. You know, the prayer requests that break my heart are the ones that said, my husband's lost his job. He's been looking for a job for months, and we're at the end of our money, and rent is past due. What do we do? And crying out to God, God, you've got to respond for these people. Or someone in a health crisis who's been cruising along through life heading into retirement, and then all of a sudden something unexpected happens, very unexpected, that is humbling to lose that kind of control over health. Uncontrolled gossip. You know, it gets out there, and especially if you're in high school, it goes through the hallways like wildfire through the mountains, and you're helpless to know what to do about it. How do you respond to those tough situations? Or family relationships that break down. You've done everything you can, and still relationships aren't right, and you're out of control. The result that you want, the outcome, is beyond your control. David's family was being ripped apart, and for good reason. Because of actions, decisions that he had made. And yet what we can see, I believe, from David as his family was being torn apart, he shows us how a man after God's own heart responds to tough situations. when we look at David, we hear those words from God, and if you're like me, you long for those to be able to say, be said about us, and we look at David, and there's hope, because he certainly made his share of messes, and if there's something about a man that had such a messy life that could still have that said about him, there's hope for us, which is the whole reason why we are doing this series that wraps up today. But he shows us on how tough situations are responded to. And this tough situation that came was God had told him that the divine protection that had been over his house was going to be lifted. It was going to break away. And I believe that if David had known it was there, he would have, it would have occurred to him at the moment when he first set eyes on Bathsheba, and his life would have gone down a different path, which would have resulted in a different outcome. But what happens when we pursue the path to pleasure, and one decision leads to another, and then we find ourselves in a place that we never thought we would be, and then we try to climb our way out? David was responding to tough situation after tough situation, but there are two key responses that I want us to look at today. And the first is that he had to surrender control. Here's what was going on. The protective covering had been lifted, and what God had said was that the sword, because you used the Ammonite sword to kill Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, the sword will never leave your house. And it wasn't a literal sword, it was figurative in many ways, but as God's protective covering was lifted, he said it was because you despised me when you took the wife of Uriah to be your own wife. Now, as I read through that in preparation for this message, it occurred to us the word despised was kind of interesting there. I mean, does that seem kind of beneath God to feel despised by someone? And yet here's what I believe he meant. Because God said to David, David, did I not call you from herding sheep and place you as king over all Israel, over the king over my people Israel? Did I not give you your master's house, his household, and all the blessings that came with that? Did I not give you blessing after blessing after blessing? And yet, if it was not enough, I would have given you more. Such is the heart of God that often gets overlooked when we're wanting more. And God says, I gave you everything you needed. I gave you more than you deserved. And yet, you were telling me through your actions, it's not enough. When we cry out to God and say, your blessings are not enough for me, God says to David, you despised me through your actions because you said my blessings were not enough for you. And because you despised me, I'm going to withdraw the protective covering that was over your household. And it began with his firstborn named Amnon. And one of the ways that Satan works is he causes us to see things, see people differently, and appeals to desires within our hearts. James said that we're tempted when the desires that are within our heart are appealed to in a way that is ungodly. And so here it was with Amnon, David's firstborn. He saw Absalom's sister Tamar differently. He saw her in a way that he began to lust after her, and he desired her. And as he complained to his friend that happened to be his cousin, now keep in mind who a cousin is when you're the son of a king. A cousin is the son of one of the king's brothers. Now, if you were here a few weeks ago, when we talked about how David was selected, the priest Samuel had gone to Bethlehem to anoint, under God's direction, one of the sons of Jesse. So he goes to Jesse and says, Jesse, God sent me here to anoint one of your sons king. Will you bring them in? So he brought them all in, except for David. Jesse didn't consider David worthy, surely anyone but David. So David stayed with the sheep. All the impressive brothers came, and Samuel went one after another down the line, and everyone, God said no. So he got to the end of the line, no more sons. And God had not revealed to him that he would anoint any of these. So he said, do you have any more? He said, well, yeah, there's just the runt, David. Well, bring him here. Well, David came. God says, that's the one. Now imagine you're one of the impressive brothers, and now your little runt brother is the one who's anointed king. There may be some resentment there. But resentment usually doesn't stop with one generation, does it? Because now the son is saying to Amnon, don't the king's sons get everything they want? And so he concocts a plan for him to lure Tamar in. And so he feigns being ill, and he only wants Tamar to bring him his camel soup. And so he has everyone else out of the room, locks the door behind her. She comes close. He grabs her, and she recognizes what he's up to. And she begged him, no, my brother, she cried, don't be foolish. Don't do this to me. Such wicked things are not done in Israel. Where could I go in my shame? And you would be called the greatest fool in Israel. Please, just speak to the king, because he will let you marry me. But he refused. He refused to listen, and because he was stronger, he raped her. And then, instantly, Satan works so that the desires that lure us into the sin then can be flipped, and then he drove her out. And he hated her, the scriptures say, with more intensity than he initially loved her. And she was driven out in shame, and she went to live as a desolate woman the rest of her life. Where? In the home of her brother Absalom. Absalom hated Amnon. He said he never talked to him about it, but he hated him. And for 2 years, he plotted revenge. And the moment came for the revenge. It was after the sheep shearing, and they're going to have a feast. And what he told his servants, when I give you the word, you're to kill Amnon. Don't be afraid. It is I who, remember, I am giving you the command. So when I say it, you just do it. And so when he said it, they did it, they killed him, and all the king's sons who were at the feast fled on their mules, and word got back to David that his family, his sons, were killing one another. In fact, word first came that they were all dead, but Absalom. Now, Absalom was considered the most handsome man in all of Israel. It says his hair, and I guess this is how you judged handsomeness then, he cut his hair once a year, and the amount that was cut weighed 5 pounds. Now, those of us that are challenged, we may take issue with that, but that's what the scripture says. And so he was someone who attracted a following, as it would come in later. So, but he fled, and Absalom's mother had come from another country. She was the daughter of the king of Geshur, which if you've read through the scriptures and you know the commands that God gave Israel when they entered the promised land to drive out all the inhabitants, because he wanted for himself a holy people set apart to serve him, because he was going to bring the Messiah through them. The Geshurites were a people that they didn't drive out. And Absalom, his mother, was the daughter of the king. And so he went there. And he was there for 3 years, hiding out from his father. Eventually, Joab, the commander of the army, brought him back, but David said, he must not enter into my presence. And Absalom found a way to get into his father's presence 2 years later. So at this point, it's a number of years later, and he's still at odds with his father. And this probably played a role in his con job as he made a play for the throne of his father, king father. Absalom, and I suppose princes get allowances, and princes have to figure, they can spend their allowance any way they want. He hired himself 50 bodyguards so he would look important. And so he had 50 bodyguards to run ahead of him. And he'd get up every morning and he would hang out at the city gates. Why? Because people would come with their complaints for the king, and he would intercede. When people brought a case to the king for judgment, Absalom would be there to listen to them. He showed interest in them, and he'd say, boy, you really have a strong case. It's too bad the king is too busy for you, but if I were judge, if I were in his position, I would surely grant you justice. And people so appreciated someone who would listen for them and care for them, since the king was too busy, they would often bow before him. And he said, no, no, you can't do that. And he would take them by the hand, kiss their hand, and lift them up. He was constantly making a play for the hearts of the people of Israel. And over a number of years, he effectively stole the hearts of the kingdom from his father. Well, the time came for the next play. And he had said to the king, let me go to Hebron to offer a sacrifice. And he made a story up. You know, the difference between a charmer and a con. A charmer manipulates the emotions of people to get what they want. A con does it intentionally. And so he told his men, and they sent a message throughout all the nation, when you hear the ram's horn, you are to declare Absalom is king over Israel. And so the ram's horn sounded. They declared Absalom has been crowned king in Hebron, and word got back to David. And this is where David has his first challenge to respond to a very tough situation. What's he do? He'd already spent how many years, maybe 10, running from King Saul for his life. And now it looks like he's going to be on the run again. A messenger came and told him, all Israel has joined Absalom in a conspiracy against you. David said, we must flee at once or it's going to be too late. You know, for being a man after God's own heart, you kind of expect better fortune than that. How many of you think that if you were a man or a woman after God's own heart, it would bring some bennies? Not the old kind of drug from the 60s, but benefits that said, you know what? If God considers me a man or a woman after his own heart, he's going to show me favor, and I'm going to be able to cut some corners, and he's going to spare me some trouble that other people would get in who aren't as good as me. And yet we don't see that at all with David. What David does is blows out of the water that God only loves those who are good, and here David is on the run again. But what we get to look at is how does a man after God's own heart respond to tough situations? And here's what he said in chapter 15, verse 14. He said, hurry, if we get out of the city. See what you observe here. If we get out of the city before Absalom arrives, what will happen? Both we and the city of Jerusalem will be spared from disaster. Who, at that moment, would be thinking of anyone but himself? Maybe a man after God's own heart. We, which is not just I, he's not, I better get out of here, and will you come with me? He said, we and the city. What were his options? What were cities like in those days? Cities had walls, and walls had gates. It had been that way for centuries. And David inside had a palace and a throne, and he had his people. He could have locked down the city, but he also knew, I think, and this is reading between the lines, that if he stayed, the city would be under siege and everyone would suffer. And maybe at some point they'd throw his body over the wall. I don't know. But he decided, let's get out of town. But here's what he did. He surrendered control. He surrendered his throne. He surrendered his palace. He surrendered the crown. He surrendered everything that brought comfort and any sense of control. He gave it up and he went on the run again, which is not what you'd expect for someone who was pleasing to God. When is this an appropriate response? I think anything where you don't have control. If you don't have control, you might as well surrender it. I know, speaking with athletes, you know, I heard for years that success as an athlete is 90% mental. And yet when you're young, you look at people and there's a big difference in physical talent. You look at somebody who is bigger, stronger, faster, and you say, he doesn't need anything on his shoulders. He needs nothing between his ears to dominate. But what happens as you go from middle school to high school to college to the pros, every time you go up, the demands, the talent gets more equal, and the distinction is all upstairs. And what successful athletes understand is that The only things that you can control are the things that you need to try to control. Here's how they say it. Control the controllables. In other words, if there's something you don't have any control over, don't worry about it. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your energy. Because you only have so much energy, and it has to go into the things that will make you successful. And if you divert it to the things you don't have control over, you're not going to advance, you're not going to win, and you're going to be really frustrated. And so whenever there is a situation where you recognize you don't have control anyway, why not surrender it to God? See, when David headed out of town, he surrendered control and he had to trust God for restoration. But that's the same thing you have to do for your reputation when it is being eaten alive by gossip or you're passed over a promotion. You can sit there and wallow in bitterness all you want, but it's not a controllable. All you have control over are your attitude and your behavior. Focus on the things, surrender control over what you really want, and pour yourself into the things that you can control. How about debt? I don't know how many times I've heard people say, you know what, and we hear it a lot through our FPU or I was broke, now I'm not classes, and they say, man, I just got a mountain of debt. And they say, well, I got into this on my own, so I need to get out of this on my own, and then I'll become obedient to God with my finances. And I think, wait a minute. You made a mess because you were on your own, and you think you're going to get out on your own? I don't think so. There's usually only one way you get on your own, and that's into trouble. Surrender control. Trust God. Put God in charge. You got into the mess without God. What makes you think you can get out of it without Him? How about estranged relationships? I know I've had relationships where I've taken responsibility for everything that God convicted me of that I did wrong and asked for forgiveness, and forgiveness was not granted, and there was nothing more I could do except surrender control and trust God for restoration. You may know that situation. You may be in that right now. And you may be tempted to seize control because all of us are fixers at heart, some of us more than others, but we desire to tinker, to fix, to seize control, and to take charge. This is also the advice I've given to offending spouses who want to hoping to reconcile after an affair. You have no rights. You just throw yourself on the mercy seat every day, and when you think you've been humbled enough, you're just getting started. Surrender control and trust God for restoration. Why is it hard? Because we want to control by nature, but the benefit of this principle is it puts God in control. But what makes it really hard is pride will always be speaking to say, I can do this myself. And we all have a desire to do this myself. I got into this mess myself. I want the pride to get out of this mess. Whether you're returning yogurt that you made a mistake and you've got to go clean up your mess or whatever it is, there's always a sense that it's better if I can clean this up myself. And it's so humbling, if not humiliating, to recognize we can't. But pride says, I can and I want to. But while pride tries to convince us to seek control, humility says, I can't. And when you put humility with faith and have humble faith, you say, I can't, but God can. And that's the essence of the humble path, where you're walking with an awareness that I can't, but God can. I can't, but God can. I need to surrender control again and again and again. And the reason is God opposes pride. Do you know why God opposes pride? Because pride says, in the very essence, I don't need God. So why would God bless pride? God's blessing then would turn our hearts further away from Him because we would be deceived thinking, I did this myself. Look, here's proof. So God opposes pride, but when there's humility that says, I can't, but God can, then God steps in. And that's when He makes Himself known. So to be people that God will bless, we've got to surrender control and trust God for restoration. So all the king and his household set out. And these are the times when the crown comes off the head that you find out who really loves you. And if you've ever been at that low point, I promise you, you don't forget. You don't forget the people who loved you, who love you without the title as much as they loved you with the title. Those are few and they're precious. And David had many of them. As he was leaving town with the crown behind him, people followed. And it's interesting to me that there are 600 men from a city called Gath that followed him. Do you know, does Gath ring a bell to anybody? Remember when David was a very young man, where did he make his mark? He was bringing some cheese and crackers one day to his brothers and seeing how the army was doing. And he said, who's that Philistine out there, that 9-foot tall guy? And why is he allowed to defy our God and the nation of Israel? And they said, haven't you seen him? He's so big. And said, big schmig, he's nothing compared to God. And so David went out and slew the giant. Do you know where the giant was from? He was from Gath. Do you know what that did to David? It seemed like forever he had a key to the city. For example, when he was running from Saul, the place that he would go where Saul wouldn't venture was Gath. More than once, David hid out in Gath, knowing that Saul didn't have the courage to go there. And now when David was at his low point, 600 men from Gath were coming along with him. The people who love you when you don't have the title are precious and few, but David had many. And so as David was leaving town, he said, if the Lord sees fit, he will bring me back again. But if he was through with me, then let him do what seems best to him. Do you have the courage to say that? That is what we mean around here when we say trust God, period. David surrendered control and trusted God for restoration at the same time knowing that God could be done with him. His reign could be over and he could be on his way to heaven, exiting the escalator out of this place. If the Lord sees fit, he will bring me back. But if he is through with me, then let him do what seems best to him. That's a man of faith. That's a man after God's own heart. And those are the kinds of things that separate him from us and challenge us to step it up. And so as David was heading out of town, hoping to just slip away, there are always going to be people who kick you when you're down. The place kicker for David was named Shimei. And, no surprise, he was a descendant, he was a member of the household of Saul. He's the same clan as Saul, the former king. You remember Saul? Saul was the one who continually pursued David and sought to kill him, and David continually said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. Time after time, he had the opportunity and probably was justified, but he refused. But now here comes this man, a descendant of Saul, walking alongside David and his men as they were leaving town, throwing stones at them, at David, the king, and the king's officers and his warriors who surrounded him. And he hollered, you know, this is trash talking at its best. The NBA doesn't have anything on Shimei. Shimei says, get out of here, you murderer, you scoundrel. The Lord, and there's always someone who puts God's name on their own opinions. The Lord is paying you back, or their judgments, for the bloodshed in Saul's clan. You stole his throne, and now the Lord is giving it to your son Absalom. At last, you get a taste of your own medicine, for you are no good murderer. Now, David was a murderer, but it certainly didn't have anything to do with taking the throne from Saul. He was a man of integrity there. And so how hard is it when you're already at your low point and somebody comes along and humiliates you with facts that aren't true and he's broadcasting them for everyone to hear? After all David did to honor Saul and the great price that he paid, and now to be kicked and knowing that he had the authority on earth to end that man's life, and he also had a volunteer to get it done. His name was Abishai. Abishai always seems to be there eager to kill somebody, because it was when Saul was asleep in camp and David said, hey, let's go for a walk. And they walked through Saul's camp and there was a spear in the ground by Saul's head. And Abishai whispered to David on that occasion, David, let me go use that spear. Let me run him through and I promise I'll only have to strike him once. And David said, no, we're not going to raise our hand against God's anointed. Well, he seemed to learn part of that lesson because he keeps trying to apply it to this man. And he says, why does this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go cut off his head. Now, you had the authority, you had the motive, and it probably maybe could have been justified, But David said, no, no. He said, if the Lord, now get this, because this is one of those separating moments. If the Lord has told him to curse me, if the Lord, because this is outside of the realm of presupposition for most of us, if the Lord has told him to deliver this message to me, to curse me, who are you to stop him? In other words, he's saying, if this is of God, I want him to throw rocks at me. Have you ever said that? No. Most of us, we don't even think in those terms because all we're thinking of God is protecting us and making life rosy good for us. But yet, if God's discipline, if the discipline and the unpleasantness of the situation is of God and he's trying to do something in your life or mine, bring on the rocks. That's faith. That's humble faith. And that is in exactly what this man after God's own heart said. If it is of God, I want him to throw rocks at me. Leave him alone, he said, and let him curse. For the Lord has told him to do it, and perhaps, now get this, because this sounds like Jesus. Perhaps the Lord will see that I'm being wronged. And you know what? I think he's still leaving the judgment up to God. Perhaps the Lord, he knows the Lord sees, but perhaps the Lord's judgment will be that I'm being wronged. And because of that, he will bless me because of the curses today. Are you willing to let people throw stones, throw rocks, and throw curses at you and trust God for vindication? You see, David not only surrendered control and trusted God for restoration of his throne and his comfort and his home and any semblance of control over his life, but he also endured humiliation as an act of faith. And he trusted God for vindication. He had every means and authority and justification to get vindication himself. But he said, no, if this is of God, I want him to throw rocks at me. And perhaps the Lord, if he sees that I'm being wronged, he will bless me. So David and his men continued down the road, and Shimei kept pace with them. I don't know what point they parted ways, but it was too long as far as they were concerned. He kept throwing rocks and cursing and throwing dirt. How hard is it to take when you're wrongfully accused, when you don't have to? At any moment, David could have said, okay, Abishai, I've had enough. Off with his head. And that would have been the end of it. But David endured humiliation, and he trusted God for vindication. This is hard, because pride will always resist the humble path. And humiliation is humble to the nth degree. Pride will always be an obstacle. It will always be hard to return something to the store that you didn't pay for. But the faith says, and the humble faith says, God will always reward me and make it worthwhile. When you end up with something at home that you didn't pay for, all these thoughts in your mind, why should I go to the trouble of burning my gas, using my time, and going back for their mistake? Because their mistake is costing me, and what it's costing me is greater value than what they sent home with me. But humble faith, the humble path, always has blessing that exceeds the cost. You know, when David said that, it sounded like Jesus. And here's what I mean, Matthew chapter 5, verse 11, where Jesus said, you are blessed when they insult and persecute you and falsely say every kind of evil against you because of me. Now, who is he? He was God. If you're there in your faith journey and you recognize Jesus as God, what he's really saying is because you're conscious of God and people falsely accuse you and berate you and persecute you, you'll be blessed. But how many want that blessing? We look at someone's life like Joseph and think, man, he was wrongfully accused, wrongfully imprisoned. He was mistreated. I wouldn't want anything to do with that. And yet what God did through all that was position him to be second in authority over the whole nation of Egypt, which saved the whole nation of Israel so that the Messiah could be born and save us all. Who's willing to let the rocks fly? Who's willing to let the curses fall on deaf ears? Who's willing to allow to leave vindication up to God? Peter. One of Jesus' disciples said, it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain. He doesn't say, he acknowledges the pain of unjust suffering. Why? Because they're conscious of God. In other words, blessed is the one who endures humiliation and trusts God for vindication. Well, the time came for the fight. David reviewed his troops and set them up. And everyone heard the king's orders, take it easy on my son, which doesn't make any sense to me because he didn't want anything to do with his son. He would not allow him into his presence. And when he invited him to the feast where he killed Amnon, it was David who at first said, no, I don't want to be a burden to you. He was not concerned about Absalom. But here he was telling his soldiers to take it easy on my boy who's trying to kill us all. So the forces marched. David's army defeated Absalom. It was a slaughter. And as Absalom was running away like a coward on his mule, he went under a tree and his hair got caught. And the mule said, I'm not waiting any longer. You're on your own. And the mule ran away and he hung there by his hair in this tree. Now, remember what his hair was. His hair was the source of his pride. His hair was his glory. And it was his downfall as well. So the men who had heard David say, take it easy on my boy, wouldn't touch him. But Joab came and ran him through three times and killed him. And when word got back to David that Absalom was dead, the king was shaken. And he went up to the room over the gateway and he wept. And he cried out, oh, my son Absalom. My son, Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. He had that opportunity, and he wouldn't have had to die physically. He would have only had to die to himself with the desires he had for that woman down that he saw on that rooftop that day. All he had to do was stop the slide and bring his temptation out into the light. But no, he didn't. Not knowing that it would cost him the lives of at least two of his sons and the shame of a daughter. See, but yet David, remember, when he surrendered control, he would have undone it all if he could at that moment. If he had thought clearly at the time when he had to make the decision, he would have thought and acted differently, and he would have set himself on a different path instead of the path of destruction. But remember, David surrendered control and trusted God for restoration. Well, God wasn't done with him, and God brought him back. So the king started back to Jerusalem, and as he was getting to the Jordan River, ready to cross and head up to Jerusalem, who should approach but Shimei? Shimei didn't wait for David to get to Jerusalem. He didn't wait for David to get across the river. He crossed the river himself, and he threw himself at the feet of David. How sweet is revenge. Here he was, baring his neck. There was Abishai with a sword. And Shimei fell down before David, and he said, my lord the king, please forgive me. He pleaded, forget the terrible thing your servant did when you left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind, for I know how much I sinned. And that is why I have come here today to be the first person in all of Israel to greet my Lord the King. Now, it sounds like David's prayer that is recorded in Psalm 51 for us in the Old Testament, where David said, I recognize my rebellion. It haunts me day and night. I have done what is evil in your sight. Blot out the stain of my sins. Wash me clean from my guilt. But you know what's true? Probably about every one of us. I'll leave that up to you. But I know it's true of me. It's a whole lot easier to ask God for mercy than it is to grant it. And here was David at this moment that this man was throwing himself at his feet, the man who had hurled rocks and insults and curses. And then Abishai steps forward and says, Shimei should die. He should die, for he cursed the Lord's anointed king. Now, that was a lesson he learned from David, to not raise your hand against the Lord's anointed, but he's applying it in a whole different way. Kill him for doing it. And David said, this is not a day for execution, for today I am once again the king of Israel. And David granted the mercy that God had given to him. Do you want more peace in your life? Only by surrendering the outcome to God will you find peace. We need to rise above the natural inclinations we have and surrender. For humble faith is the only path to peace. So how do we live it out? Well, what are you holding on to at the expense of others? Where'd that come from our story? That was when David left Jerusalem for the city's sake and not just his own. So what are you holding on to at the expense of others? How can you wield authority for mercy, not revenge? That we know people who wield authority and use it for revenge and to hurt people. We see it in Washington all the time. But who wields authority for mercy? What do you need to trust God to restore? Where do you need to trust God for vindication? Every week, we celebrate communion. And we do this because Jesus said, "Do this to remember me." What do you remember about Jesus? I mean, yes, if you're his follower, you celebrate your forgiveness and the salvation that came as a result, but there's more to remember than just salvation. Let's remember that Jesus chose the humble path, did he not? Jesus chose the humble path, he surrendered control, and he trusted his Father for restoration. He endured humiliation, and he trusted his Father for vindication. He was on the cross, naked, and he had people hurling insults at him. You who saved others, you cannot even save yourself. What an imposter you are. He had to take it. It was humiliating. And he had to trust his Father for vindication. He surrendered everything David did and more. And the Bible says about him to us that we should have the same mindset in us that Jesus had. Who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used for his own advantage, but rather he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. He chose the humble path. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess. In heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. That's what communion is about. It's declaring what he did for me. He's my only source of hope. But it's also declaring that I am his follower in having the same mindset to surrender control, to endure humiliation, and trust God with the outcome that I cannot achieve on my own. Jesus, thank you for your presence today, for the work that you're doing. And I pray you'll have your way with me, with us, with your church. And we pray this because you left heaven and came to earth to give us that opportunity and privilege. Amen.